Hello and welcome to the Bedrock Learning Podcast. I'm Liv.
I'm Alex. This is episode 3, A Long-Term Commitment.
We're recording this podcast in July 2021 at the end of a very difficult 18 months, really, hasn't it been, Alex?
Yeah, it's been what a time. Exhaustion is rife.
Agreed. So today we're going to be talking about teacher well-being and what that can look like for building a sustainable culture that improves literacy in your school.
So in terms of the context of July 2021, on the 10th of May, so just a few months ago, and this is in response to everything that's been going on, and actually, frankly, not even just the pandemic, way before that, this has always been an issue for teachers, is workload, burnout, exhaustion, and how do we make this a sustainable career, essentially? Mm. And how do we help schools run efficiently and smoothly whilst, you know, actually improving literacy and education outcomes?
And I think one of the concerns that we have when we speak to teachers is they say, well, how are we going to really embed all of these ideas? Yeah. You know, we already have got a very busy timetable. How are we going to find the time? So today we're going to talk a bit about the staff wellbeing charter that was recently announced. And we're going to be talking about ways we can make sustainable changes in our schools. What does that charter involve? What does it look like for schools, Alex?
Well, schools can sign up to it and commit, say, you know, we are committing to this charter. And, you know, I think in terms of Ofsted, so it says, you know, includes 12 commitments on education staff wellbeing by the DfE and Ofsted. So I can assume when Ofsted are going in, it's going to be part of their inspection. Yes, you know, you put all these things in place for student outcomes, but what do you have to support your staff body in terms of wellbeing? So there's going to be perhaps tension there for schools. But actually, I know from, you know, reading TESS articles and listening to Radio 4 that there's, you know, been a lot of schools that they've selected a wellbeing lead. And they're not just the wellbeing lead for students, but also for staff. And a lot of schools are really marrying the two, pastoral and academic, and making it more of a holistic approach for everyone. So schools being seen as more microcosms of society and mini communities.
Which that, they are, of course.
Exactly, exactly. Yeah. And just tapping into that for everyone in the community, teachers involved.
I remain cautious about this. I think it's an excellent idea, and I think it will just depend on leadership, won't it, to see the impact that this can have. And you're right, there is a tension there, isn't there, between a job that is perennially demanding,
yeah,
and time intensive,
yeah,
and staff wellbeing.
I do also think the idea that teaching is a vocation means that, well, I certainly felt like this, you can never do enough. And so just that feeling alone is enough to make someone stressed. Yeah, I think it's something to keep an eye on. But hopefully it's a success. I really do think that. But it's it does need to be applied.
We're using this as the background today to think about changes we can make in our school practice, in our culture, to improve literacy outcomes for students.
Yeah.
So let's have a think then about some ways that schools have been going about that.
So, number one, an outward-facing strategy. So, as I said, you know, making it a community focus and bringing in parents as well as students and teachers. Number two, and this taps into the same thing, making it part of the school culture, not just an initiative, not just a box-ticking exercise. Number three, actually including students in the process and empowering them so they're driving literacy improvement as well as you and the parents. And then number four, how do we go about it? It does require planning.
So we need to think about how we involve all stakeholders in our school communities in improving literacy and improving outcomes. And actually, Alex, you've done a lot of work around the involvement of parents with literacy learning, haven't you?
Yes. Yeah. It's kind of a passion of mine.
Okay.
The EEF in 2018, they put together recommendations on how we can have active parent-school or home-school partnerships. So I think with parents, over this lockdown period, I think they've really embraced online forms of communication, text messaging. And I know a lot of schools actually been knocking on doors. But actually having that parents' evening, having that open day, whether it is virtual or face-to-face, is so crucial, those touch points. But actually it's what we do in them and how we speak and what language you use that it can be transformative.
I think you mentioned online learning there. I think that has been transformative for lots of parents, because if I think about phonics, for example, I'm a secondary English teacher, but I'm not an expert in teaching reading and in phonics. And it can be quite a dense, tricky subject to get your head around. So,
Especially if you weren't taught that way.
Exactly. And so I think one thing that has been really positive during lockdown and during school closures is that parents are seeing phonics teaching in action.
Yeah.
And it's really helping them to understand how they can further support their children.
Yeah.
So I think schools need to grasp that with both hands and think, what other opportunities are there for kind of teaching the parents the way that we do things,
yeah.
you know, the way that we approach teaching times tables, the way we approach all of the literacy concerns in our classrooms. I think that's going to be really, really useful, and that could be a transformative change in schools.
Well, actually, you know, the parents that I surveyed and spoke to during my MA on parent-school partnerships, they all really appreciate that.
Mm.
Hands up, they often say, look, actually, when homework comes home, particularly from a specific subject that they don't feel confident in, they are unsure on how to help. So the Oxford Language Report suggests like one-minute guides. And actually, if we do have booklets, for instance, or a clear curriculum with clear words that we are teaching and clear topics, then parents are going to know what's coming up and be able to support a little bit more from the home perspective. I know that historically, if a parent comes in and says, how do I improve my child's vocabulary or literacy? We've said, get them to read more. And I know I always say, you know, anything, newspapers, magazines, everything, that's reading. But what would you recommend if you had a parent come in and say, like, how am I going to help my child?
I think this is where planning comes in. And this is where the importance of a coherent vocabulary curriculum comes in. Because how powerful is it to say to a parent, these are the words that your child is going to be coming across in the autumn term, the spring term, the summer term. Be using these in your speech around the dining table, whatever, you know, wherever you eat, just any time at all in the house. The more we can expose children to this language, the better. So, you know, Bedrock, for example, has the parent dashboard, which shows them very clearly the words that the students are using.
Yeah.
But if schools aren't using Bedrock, they're doing, you know, their vocab curriculum themselves. That's something that could be given to parents, like word lists.
Yeah. And that really empowers parents.
Yeah.
And it means that discussion is focused around teaching and learning.
Yeah.
Often our discussions with parents are focused around behaviour. Mm. And actually, we want to bring it back to teaching and learning, because that's what's important in schools, really.
Yeah.
I think parents being able to see the progress their child's making and see the gains that they're making and have confidence in you and confidence in themselves to support their child and where they're going can only be a good thing.
I think also we always talk about the importance of creating language rich communities. And I think if we can involve parents in celebrating great language. You know, maybe postcards home saying, I'm so impressed by this student's use of vocabulary in their writing, you know, really bringing
with
it
a specific
to the forefront.
Word, perhaps.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And really celebrating that with the parents is would be a powerful thing as well.
Yeah. And I know there are schools that do parent lessons. And I think you've got to think about your particular context and community. It's so specific to your, you know, your community. There was one school that I worked with in the north of England, and they have parents that were difficult to reach out to, even via text, even via email. But then they thought, right, they're not coming in the evening, because actually a lot of them are at work. But if we had a coffee morning with coffee, biscuits, donuts, and then we could celebrate Bedrock or whatever, you know, we're getting the students to do, it's a really good way in. And that actually opened the floodgates and parents were coming in, and they could actually, often the issues were just like, oh, I didn't get any of these emails because I hadn't signed in on this. Oh, okay, I'll help you do that. And it takes 5 minutes or 2 minutes.
Just breaking down barriers.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And then just one last one. I know some are doing sort of lessons. I know another school in sort of West Midlands, they do evening lessons of Bedrock, and actually the parents are working through it themselves.
Oh, right. So involving all stakeholders in the language, creating that language culture in your school. Secondly, we're going to talk about how we need to see literacy improvement as a culture as opposed to a bolt-on initiative. And I think historically that has been one of the barriers for schools taking on EdTech specifically, or, you know, new products, is that they think, well, we're doing all these things already, we can't have another initiative. And I think I would agree, like, that's not a good way of doing things, is it? Just plugging things in.
It's all got to be integrated.
Exactly.
And
it's got to be a vision.
Connected. Yeah.
So how might schools go about creating that kind of language rich culture, Alex? What are some of the things that they might do?
Well, some of the things I've seen work really well, particularly actually at the school that we worked at, was the push on reading. Every single child had a book in their bag. That was the expectation. Every single child, it was made very clear, the expectations at the beginning of the year, you read 20 minutes every day. And that's just a fiction. I'm not sure what specific departments did, but it'd be great if they were supporting the non-fiction reading as well. But yeah, I think creating that reading culture has got to be, and also expecting the staff to have a book in their bag as well.
Yeah, I think modelling. You know, if I think about, for, you know, Alice Visser-Fiore, who writes a lot about bringing reading front and centre in schools, an amazing resource on social media. Mm. And she talks about very extensively about recommendations for key stage 2, 3, and 4. So obviously teachers, English teachers maybe specifically, reading the books that they're able to recommend to the students, that's a very powerful thing, as opposed to always going back to the same old books that you recommend year in, year out. And then you know your children, don't you? And you know the texts that are in the library, and you can do some beautiful matching up and take children to the books you know they'll enjoy. I think involvement of teachers, yes, modelling, yes, always having those books, but also reading the texts that their students are going to be reading.
I really like the whole, over the summer, read a few of the recent Carnegie Award books or Booker Prize for children, because actually there's some brilliant books that come out every single year on some very topical issues. So if we can recommend them. Because I know, I mean, I was guilty of this. I would think about books that I read at their age and be like, oh, Jacqueline Wilson. But, you know,
that's
all great.
Yeah.
But there's actually lots of more modern writers coming through. And also, again, it's thinking about your community.
And one thing that teachers have been talking to us about is ways that they're embedding tier two vocabulary in their kind of everyday school lives. For example, giving the word list that you have got planned to the senior leadership team in assembly and saying, hey, can you just slip in these tier two words anywhere you like in your assembly this week? Just gaining opportunities for exposure, as many exposures to this language as is possible. And you spoke to a teacher, didn't you, about, was it their behaviour?
Yes, so Oasis Oldham, fantastic teacher there, Rebecca O'Neill. She is planning on implementing it in within all of the policies. So using tier two vocabulary in the behaviour policy, for example. Mm. So for instance, words such as recommendations and would be used, and defiant might be used. And students, it's just part of the school culture and language. And students just come to learn what they mean and perhaps start using them themselves.
Yeah, and that's a really nice way as well of doing what we call semantic padding, isn't it? So yes, you can use that tier two language, but you can also give them a tier one word around it, so they're starting to really unpick that, those meanings.
Yeah, and also it's a good way of getting that staff buy-in from maybe, you know, teachers that haven't necessarily bought in, but because it's part of your school policy language, that's what they're going to use, because so they're naturally using it without you having to sort of labour the point.
Yeah. Empowering students.
Yes.
How can we go about that? What do we mean by that, Alex?
I think when it comes to language learning, the obvious one is teaching morphology really explicitly, roots and affixes, and how you can build words, and how, you know, the patterns within language, particularly Latin and Greek roots, which are very common in the English language, particularly in academic language. Students love it, for one. It's kind of interesting. Finite. Now I know how to spell definitely. Pare. Now I know how to spell separate. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
I think it helps with the spellings.
So helpful with spellings as well.
But it helps with the meanings. And actually, you know, they can see, oh, the word un, when it's put in front of all these words, it's the opposite to that word, as it, you know, unimportant, for example. And actually, it's not necessarily, we see it in language because we do lots of reading. But for students that aren't doing as much reading as they should be, it's not something they notice straight away unless we point it out to them.
So I have a top tip for this.
Yes.
Because currently in Bedrock, we are building a new morphology unit.
Yeah.
A more extensive one than the one we've currently got. And what I've found is that if you're looking for a way in with morphology, start with the roots. Okay. As opposed to the affixes. So, okay. For example, teaching suffixes can be a little bit tricky because you're looking at, for example,
tenses.
O-U-S, M-E-N-T. Like, they don't have kind of their own meaning as such. Whereas with the roots...
They're quite abstract,
yeah,
aren't they?
Exactly. Whereas with the roots, there are some really lovely examples of that unlocking meaning. So, for example, if you know that bio means life, you can start thinking about biology, the study of living things. So it's just, I think that is really empowering for students, and it kind of unlocks the key, doesn't it? And I remember one moment in one of my classes, the kind of the light, the penny dropping as they saw that bits of the words mean different things and that you can apply those rules across different words.
And when they're sat in their exams,
yeah, exactly.
And a word comes up, that they don't recognise, you've given them the tools to just break it down. Okay, I recognise this part, so this is going to mean potentially this.
Yeah, I think there's a confidence issue there as well, isn't there? That even if they don't actually end up getting the right meaning, it's that you've given them some tools and strategies to break down unfamiliar words so that they can start to have a go themselves. So even if they're not quite getting it right, they're having a go. They're not daunted by that new language.
I think that taps into sort of our next point on empowering students is making all strategies explicit. We talked last time about our processes and thinking within our particular subject are invisible unless we make them visible. So, you know, before I read, I'll look at the title and make assumptions about what I'm just about to read. Mm. And we need to tell students that, okay, we make predictions before we read, looking at the colours used, the images used, and drawing from our life, you know, what we associate with it. And actually, I used to say to students, especially if they were secondary, you've actually had a lot of life experience. You know, you've seen and heard and felt and lots of different things. Use that.
Another strategy that we've seen used really effectively, and I've used in my own classrooms, is having somebody, a student, responsible for language in your room.
Yeah.
And so I used to call it the oracy monitor. And
lovely.
In the younger classes, I actually got them to wear a high-vis vest, which they
love. Oh, they love
they
that.
They love a high-vis vest. Yeah. And so that person was responsible for noting down amazing examples of language all the way through the lesson. And then at the end of the lesson, they would have a kind of 2-minute slot just to remark on everything they've heard. And they'd have a dictionary with them. They could look up the meaning of the word if they weren't sure. It was just a really great way of foregrounding great use of language.
Mm. And they took it in turns, did they?
They took it in turns, yeah. And, you know, they loved it. They, you know, they found it a really fun thing to do.
Did you let them write on the board? Because they always love that.
Yeah, I actually let them write on the windows.
Wow.
I know, crazy, right?
Bold move.
Yeah. With removable pens, obviously.
Yeah, of course.
but, yeah, I think, and actually just for the other students, knowing that there was a student kind of picking out their excellent language,
yeah,
it really made them tune in to the importance of their vocabulary. So I think it was it was a winning strategy all around.
That kind of taps into something I heard Alex Quigley say, which is naturally when we're reading, like reading fluency, which is a lot of people are talking about at the moment, we correct ourselves naturally, and that's fine. And a lot of students expect an expert reader to never have to correct themselves, but we do. And actually, when we're speaking, we correct ourselves, right? I mean, over this
we're
podcast.
We're going to edit this.
Yeah, exactly. So I think that's quite exciting. If you're a student that has an oracy monitor and you've maybe used the word nice, and then they can say, oh, okay, there's someone in a high-vis vest over there that's looking at my language. Oh, I might say, exceptional. And then I might get, recognised for it at the end of the lesson. Yeah. And it's just, that's what you do is, you know, if you're an expert in writing, you're naturally doing that. You're kind of thinking, you're kind of self-editing.
Totally. And I think, you know, the primary school that I work with, they've embedded a writing sequence. And one of those parts is obviously editing, going back and
crucial,
trying to improve. And so the oracy work actually just rehearses that editing process, doesn't it?
Just another thing on roles and responsibilities, this does also, in terms of sustainability and in terms of perhaps behaviours in schools. I know a lot of schools have said, you know, since the pandemic, a lot of their students come back quite anxious and reluctant to engage or participate in conversation,
right,
or just generally in the learning. So that's been an area that a lot of schools are working on. And I think, you know, if you do have a range of roles, so, okay, right, you're handing out the books, you're handing out this, and you can write the names and you're going to tick off the tasks. I used to write up the tasks on the board. It just kind of creates that culture, going back to culture, of, right, we're a team, we're working together, and we all want everyone to do well.
Yeah.
And I think that does help with behaviour generally. I found that even with year 10s and 11s, yeah, they do appreciate that. Sometimes they sort of humour you, but really it does motivate them.
Yeah. Kind of ironic enjoyment.
Yes, sure, exactly. Sure. Same with stickers and all of those things.
And lastly, we are going to talk about planning today, Alex.
Yeah.
And I don't know, I think this is something that can often...
It's very daunting.
It can feel daunting, can't it? But all of the things that we've spoken about today, so for example, engaging parents, engaging our stakeholders, bringing reading front and centre, using routes to empower students, the planning at the beginning of those processes will stand you in good stead year on year on year.
Yeah.
It's not like you're going to have to do this every year.
Yeah. And actually, if your planning is made with the idea of things being manageable, meaningful and sustainable all the time, then they will last the test of time. There will be a long term commitment. And I know, you know, all the policies that were in place in our school that we worked at, they never changed. They just got reinforced each year. No one had to rewrite or reinvent the wheel because it's just good quality teaching and learning at the end of the day. So if you can plan in terms of your tier two, the same old tier two words are coming up across the curriculum every single year, every single exam paper across the board, right? Just keeping that solid and always bearing in mind that you've got to assess. You've got to teach and you've got to reteach, and just always keeping that loop. So it's got to be adaptive, obviously, for your cohorts. But yeah, planning. And then obviously your tier three for each subject area is crucial. And I think the tier three element is crucial to get staff buy-in as well. So you can say, look, these are on the specifications for SAT and GCSE. So let's address them. Let's teach them. You're teaching them anyway. But let's make sure that we're all doing it in a consistent way.
I think that point about not reinventing the wheel is really crucial. If you are looking for a vocabulary curriculum, you know, we have word lists on our website that people could access. There are lots of schools around the country who have word lists available on their websites.
Yeah.
We spoke about School 21 for Oracy Policy, didn't we, a few episodes ago? And I just think those resources are out there.
Yeah.
It doesn't need to be a massive outlay of time initially, but that kind of thoughtful process at the start of the year will enable sustainable change to take place throughout the year.
Yeah, I think the only thing I would warn against is word lists. I mean, they are very helpful as a starting point, but as you know, as we teach vocabulary and as like really good language learning is, it's contextual. So just if you want a deep and broad curriculum in line with the Ofsted recommendations, it's got to be within context of non-fiction and fiction texts.
Very good point. Yeah.
But then once you've done that, and if they're, you know, a rich and diverse range of topics, they're not going to become outdated.
Yeah. So today we've just had a think about how to make sustainable change in schools in order to improve literacy. And we've spoken about a number of things, Alex.
We have. And importantly, this is in light of what's happened, the pandemic, the new charter for staff wellbeing. But yes, we really need to have outward facing strategies, thinking about all stakeholders.
We've spoken about not using bolt-on initiatives, but thinking about whole school culture and how we might make that more of a language rich culture.
Absolutely. And empowering students with explicit strategies so that they feel confident to also walk alongside you improving literacy.
And lastly, we've spoken about the importance of planning initially so that you save yourself time in the long run. If you have any ideas that you are using in your schools that you believe would help other teachers make more sustainable changes to improve literacy, we'd love to hear from you. So drop us a note on our social media channels and we'd love to talk about them next time.
You can find this podcast on Spotify, Apple, Buzzsprout.
Any of your usual podcast providers.
Thank you.
Goodbye.